Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, Laboratory Chief of Biochemical Genetics at the National Heart Institute, the now late Dr. Marshall Nirenberg, and Chief of the Laboratory of Molecular Biology at the National Institute of Disorders and Stroke, Dr. Ron McKay, discuss neurobiology and the science behind it. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm head of the Laboratory of Biochemical Genetics in the National Heart Institute here at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. I've been here since 1957. I came as a postdoctoral fellow, and I've stayed here ever since. During the early 60s, my colleagues and I deciphered the genetic code. And for that, I was awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine. And even after the code was deciphered, it was too easy. We had wonderful projects going, but it was like I could do it with one hand tied behind my back, I felt. And I really wanted to explore, and I wanted a challenge. And so I went into neurobiology. I changed fields totally and went into neurobiology. At the time, about a year before that, somebody had grown muscle cells in culture, and they stayed differentiated. Up to that time, this is a clonal line of muscle cells. Before that time, people thought that if you take a single cell and derive a population of cells from this to make a clonal cell line, that the cells would de-differentiate in culture, and that you couldn't grow differentiated cells in culture. This was the first time it had been done for muscle cells. So I decided to try to get clonal lines of a tumor of neurons, neuroblastoma cells, to establish them in culture to use as simple model systems for studying problems in neurobiology. And my real objective was to get cells that express neural properties sufficiently so they could form synapses. And so we could use this model system to study various properties of synapse formation and communication between cells. And eventually, we found five cell lines that would form synapses with striated muscle cells. And we used these for many different purposes. We found that synapse formation was regulated, and expression of neural properties was regulated, and that we could shift cells to a differentiated state and innervate 100% of the muscle cells. And we used these systems for different things. One line we found had many opiate receptors, covered with opiate receptors actually, and so we wondered if we could study the mechanism of addiction or dependence upon opiates, and we found we could. We found a molecular basis for opiate dependence, withdrawal, and tolerance using these cells as a model system. Roger Sperry in the early 60s proposed a really interesting hypothesis that he said that every cell in the retina, in a sheet of cells in the retina, could be given a unique address with two gradients of molecules at right angles to one another. And that would label each cell uniquely, so that it could be given an address. And I thought of a way of testing this using monoclonal antibodies, that is, cell lines that make antibodies. Each cell line makes a different species of antibody, a different kind of antibody. So we immunized, we used as the immunogen, chick embryo retina, different portions of chick embryo retina, and looked for an antigen, a molecule in retina that was non-uniformly distributed in retina. And wonder of wonders, we found one. that was distributed in a dorsal, large dorsal ventral gradient in retina that defined actually the dorsal ventral axis of the retina. We purified it. We found that it was a protein, a membrane protein. I tried to clone DNA corresponding to it, but failed. And because of this, I went into, and because we needed a genetic handle for it, we started to work with Drosophila. And we looked for new Drosophila homeobox genes. Homeobox genes are members of a family of genes that encode proteins that that regulate other genes. They're DNA binding proteins. And we were lucky enough to find four new homeobox genes, and one of them we found later initiates the neural pathway of development in part of the central nervous system in Drosophila. And so this provided a means of studying the initiation of neural development and the strategy of initiating neural development.
Maybe I could ask you something. It seems to me that a motif that informs a lot of the work that you've done is this: is the idea of a code, the idea that there's a genetic code. First, there's a genetic code for proteins.
Well,
then there's, in a sense, Sperry's work says there's a genetic code for important features of the nervous system.
Well, I mean, there are only two systems in biology that process information. And I mean, the genetic and the neural. And so that was basically the unifying concept between the switch from the code to the eye. I mean, I didn't go in looking for any kind of a code, although I think that axon pathfinding and so forth, obviously the axons detect molecules on the surface of the cells that they're crawling over, that they're adhering to, and that these are positional molecules that convey information about where to go and how to find the right kind of synaptic partner. I don't think of it as particularly as a code, although Bill Dreyer calls it the area area code hypothesis, like a telephone number. Right.
There are two major events, you say, in biology. One is the genetic code, the code that leads to the expression of proteins and the differentiation of cells. And then there's a second kind of information processing event where synapses become active.
Yes.
And process information. So there's two major
Yes.
kinds of information processing event. I mean, this is the nature-nurture debate, which is classic, really, in biology, which is
Mm-hmm.
what's encoded in the genes and what is regulated by sensory information that comes into animals from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. Those issues still remain major issues.
They
in,
do.
In neuroscience and in clinical medicine, actually.
Actually, nobody understands really how neurons select appropriate synaptic partners to form appropriate synapses compared to inappropriate synapses. Whether there is, in fact, there have to be specific molecules that are involved that tell a neuron when it's at the right place. But in some cases, it's a process of selection.
Ask you a simple question. Why did you get interested in the first place in working on the genetic code? What was the motivation when you first started thinking about
working on it? The motivation for that was I had just finished my PhD as a biochemist. I came here as a postdoctoral fellow in biochemistry. So I was very much interested at the time in molecular biology. I mean, molecular biology and the work that Minot and Jacob were doing in the Pasteur Institute in Paris was on how beta-galactosidase gene is the expression of this gene is regulated. These are genetic experiments in E. coli. Were the most exciting things that were going on in science, I thought, at the time.
Yes.
And they were incredibly beautiful experiments, sophisticated genetic experiments to try to understand the nature of gene regulation. And so my initial idea was to try to get a cell-free protein synthesizing system going sufficient so that I could synthesize an inducible enzyme in a cell-free extract, and then study mechanisms of regulation at the molecular level. Mm-hmm. And to do this, at the time, there was no such thing as messenger RNA. There was only ribosomal RNA, and transfer RNA had just been discovered, adapter RNA. I thought that messenger RNA must exist. I wasn't sure whether DNA per se coded for was the code for proteins, the information in DNA, or whether there was an RNA intermediary. I was pretty sure that there was an RNA intermediary, that the information flowed from DNA to RNA.
Why did you think there was an RNA?
Well, you know, there was no evidence of any kind at that time for messenger RNA,
yeah.
But I just assumed that messenger RNA existed. And I assumed that it must exist, and I thought that one place that must have low levels of messenger RNA would be ribosomal RNA, because ribosomes are particles that protein is synthesized on ribosomes.
And you knew that?
And I knew that. Then that was clearly established that there was amino acid incorporation on ribosomes.
Right.
And so I thought that there must, part of the RNA, I thought, may RNA that encodes protein. It's the template for protein.
And were you amongst the first people to make a cell-free system for protein synthesis?
No. Zamechnik and Phil Sikovits and his colleagues, Zamechnik's colleagues, had for years studied radioactive amino acid incorporation into protein. They got very low levels of incorporation into protein in a cell-free system. But there was a paper that appeared by Lamborg and Zamechnik on a system for E. coli, for protein synthesis in E. coli, that had a little bit higher activity than the mammalian systems that had been used. And I thought that was very exciting, and that was my starting point for the cell-free system.
But you focused very quickly on the question of code, did you?
No, the first thing I tried to do was to ask the question, does messenger RNA exist? Is protein encoded by DNA or by RNA? And so I looked for a fraction of DNA or RNA that would stimulate amino acid incorporation into protein. And I looked, used penicillinase, which Pollock in England had used. It was a second inducible enzyme system like beta-galactosidase. Very few people were working on it, but it was a very small protein, and the protein lacked cysteine. So I thought that if I simply added all amino acids except cysteine, maybe I could shut off amino acid synthesis, I mean protein synthesis other than penicillinase, and could get penicillinase synthesis. Uh-huh. That was my starting point.
Did you succeed in that experiment?
No. Well, what I started to do was to prepare RNA and DNA fractions, add it to cell-free extracts, and look first for protein synthesis, for enzyme activity, and then for amino acid incorporation, a more sensitive assay. And almost after about a year and a half working on this problem, I thought it would take me 2 years to get things really going. I thought that the field of protein synthesis was moving so fast, I thought, that in 2 years, protein synthesis could be solved. By that time, I'll have the system set up. I had never worked in this field before, and so I was completely ignorant about, I thought it would take me 2 years to learn the literature, to set up the systems, to get things going. By that time, somebody else would solve protein synthesis,
yeah,
and then I'd be set to study regulation. But we soon found that RNA stimulated amino acid incorporation to protein. This was the first evidence, real evidence, that we had that there was messenger RNA existed.
Where did you get this RNA from? Was this a synthetic RNA?
No,
or was it still
this was
E. coli?
ribosomal RNA.
Right.
And
which was contaminated with message, was it? Is that
contaminated with message? Yeah. That's what I thought it would be.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, we fractionated the RNA and found that only a portion of it was active as a template for protein synthesis. So anyway, once we found ribosomal RNA was active, I tried viral RNA. I tried every RNA we could get our hands on to see what the activity was. And tobacco mosaic virus RNA was just hot as blazes. I mean, with ribosomal RNA, we got 35 counts above background.
Right.
And by manipulating the system and studying, we were able to increase that to maybe 150 counts, 200 counts.
Right.
But with viral RNA, we got thousands of counts going into protein above background. I mean, it was really exciting.
Yes.
So then we tried, we got synthetic polynucleotides and looked to see if we would form a protein consisting only of one amino acid, a kind of amino acid, and made 20 different mixtures of amino acids, each lacking a different amino acid, put a different radioactive amino acid in that, and looked for incorporation. And poly-U was amazing, stimulated incorporation of phenylalanine of all the 20 amino acids, only a phenylalanine into protein. And that was like 50,000 counts above background. It was really staggering. And so that's, once we had that, that was clearly the first, a series of U's was clearly the first.
And were you synthesizing the RNA as well at this point?
Yes, we were
doing the chemistry to make the RNAs.
Well, initially, Leon Heppel was, you know, at that time there were maybe a dozen people in the world who were really good nucleic acid biochemists. Leon Heppel was really an outstanding nucleic acid biochemist here at the NIH, and so he had many of these things. Actually, the first RNA we got from Dan Bradley, the first poly-U, we got from Dan Bradley, who was a physical chemist who was studying the properties of this. But they were synthesized using, synthesis was catalyzed by polynucleotide phosphorylase, an enzyme that had been discovered by Severo Ochoa and Marianne Grünberg-Winago a little while before. And with using this enzyme, you could synthesize randomly ordered polynucleotides. And so this is, we synthesized randomly ordered polynucleotides of all kinds to find the base compositions of codons. And later we found a method, a very simple method of determining the sequences of the codons.
So did you become, when you understood that you were going to be able to solve the sequence relationship between the RNA and the amino acid sequence, was there then a period which was short or long when the actual code itself was worked out?
It took 5 or 6 years of intense work by, I guess in our group there was never more than maybe 9 people working at one time, but a total of like 20 people all in all over this period of time worked on this problem. And so it was very much a group project, and we worked flat out as hard as we could. It was a wonderful time. I mean, to have a problem like that is exciting.
It was a recognized problem. So once you had a start, it must have been very exciting, because often I think in science problems are not recognized, and so people feel rather isolated when they're actually solving the problem.
This was a defined, yes, a highly defined problem. It took a lot of work to make the oligonucleotides, to make the triplets. We found that the shortest message was 3 bases, 3 nucleotide residues, a trinucleotide, but they'd never been made before. They'd never been isolated. And so we had to synthesize 64 trinucleotides and then test them to determine the specificity of these.
So, I mean, it's listening to you talk, it seems in some ways that it was fortunate that you were able actually to get synthetic RNAs to promote amino acids incorporation.
Yes.
Was it inefficient, even though, say, poly-U was efficient relative to other RNAs?
The other polynucleotides were very efficient also.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that had no structure were very efficient. We showed that the double-stranded RNA was inactive, and that GG interactions between that high content of G destroyed the activity of the template because of base pairing between G residues.
Right.
We went through it twice. First with synthetic polynucleotides, then with triplets.
Do you think then that in that period, when at the end of it, when you realized in a sense that you had done what you wanted to do in that area, what was that transition like for you personally? I mean, was it a letdown, or were you excited to move forward?
Oh no, I was excited to move forward because we were under a lot of pressure to get the work out, because when we first published this, Severo Ochoa, who was one of the foremost biochemists in the world, jumped on the problem.
Yes.
I was faced with competition, with an extremely experienced biochemist, extremely experienced in making RNA, making synthetic polynucleotides, because he and Marianne Grünberg-Winago had discovered method of making synthetic RNA. I later learned that the reason that he jumped, I didn't know this until way after this was done, is that somebody from France, Mirko Beljanski, came to his lab on a sabbatical, and he asked him to look at the template activity of poly-A, synthetic RNA, which codes for polylysine. And Mirko worked for a year on this and was unable to find poly-A was active as a template. The reason he was unable to find it is that polylysine is soluble in trichloroacetic acid.
So he couldn't precipitate. Yeah.
He would have found it otherwise. And
yeah.
So of course, Severo Ochoa jumped on the problem. I mean, he independently had the idea. He was also
very well known and received many honors himself.
Oh, he was president of the International Biochemical Union and a Nobel Prize winner.
That's right.
Which he won for the polynucleotide phosphorylase.
And he was at Rockefeller, was he? Where was he?
He was at NYU.
Ah, yeah.
When I had never met him, and when he first jumped on the problem, I thought, well, it's, you know, I would, this competition, I was a little afraid. I was askance at competition. A little afraid that I'd be swamped, because I was working with one person at the time, with Heinrich Mattei. And so when I went to New York one time to give a talk, I called him up, introduced myself, and he invited me to come down to have tea, introduced me to all of the members of his department. I thought maybe we could divide up the problem and help one another, because it seems like a much more civilized thing to do to be cooperative rather than to be competitive. But that was impossible. I mean, it was impossible to divide it up. And I discovered, to my horror, that I like to compete. It stimulates you.
Yes.
But after competing for 5 years and writing a paper every 6 weeks, and you know, it takes a lot out of you, and you want to read and think and put things back in. And so at the end of this time, I was relieved to switch fields. I mean, I did it. It was one of the happiest times of my life.
And it was recognized at that point, wasn't it? That, I mean, I think a lot of your colleagues here at NIH knew the importance of your work. So you were quite strongly supported here, isn't
very,
that? So,
very strongly supported.
Yes.
And some people helped Maxine Singer and Bob really were major help. And having Heppel here, Heppel was a tremendous help. He gave us oligonucleotides. You know, Heppel, I don't know if you've ever met Leon Heppel.
No.
He's a wonderful person, very like a bird-like person, always working at the bench. And I never wanted to interrupt him. You know, I would, uh-huh. if I needed something, I would open the door and just stand there, and he'd right. be working, and I'd just wait until he came to a stopping place, and then I'd ask him something, and then leave immediately, because I didn't want to interfere with his work. But he was a big help.
And in the transition, did your colleagues here understand the transition, and that now that you were going to move on, did you feel
they
that
thought
you
I was crazy?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now that was another yeah. kind of individual move for you.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right. I think it always is actually for a scientist.
I gave all of the postdoctoral fellows I was working with to Tom Kasky, who was a terrific guy in the lab, and I mean they were interested in protein synthesis, and there were many things to do with protein synthesis, and I started by myself working in neurobiology, but it was the most wonderful sense of freedom to simply read. And although I must say that the experiments, the intellectual level of experiments in molecular biology is so much higher than the, some of the papers that I read in neurobiology, in the nervous system, neurochemistry, were so horrible. I mean, technically they were bad.
Right.
And it felt like I was walking through swamps.
But isn't that true, I think, in any field? I mean, there must have been a period, I think, when molecular biology was also a very complex subject and people hadn't really focused in on the main issues. And for example, biochemists, mm-hmm. I understand, thought in the early part of molecular biology that molecular biologists weren't a competent collection of people, and that they couldn't think straight, and they couldn't do experiments properly. And I think that's also true in neuroscience, that the early phase of molecular neuroscience,
yeah.
there were parts of the discipline that were well developed. I mean, neurochemistry had some areas. Neurotransmitter chemistry was very well developed, but many of the important problems were poorly phrased, really, experimentally.
Yes, absolutely.
So who influenced you in that period, when you were making the transition?
There was nobody I thought of, well, maybe I should go someplace, but there was nobody really that that I could go to. So I became friends and colleagues and collaborated with Phil Nelson, Philip yeah. Nelson here at the NIH, superb neurophysiologist. And he taught me the language of neurophysiology. I taught him molecular biology. And it was a wonderful exchange for both of us.
Yes.
And we both learned. It was very productive because we had all of these neuroblastoma cell lines, which he could use then to study the electrophysiologic correlates. We found that the ion channels were inducible, and it was really productive. I think it benefited both of us very much. And he taught me a lot. So and then I just read everything I could lay my hands on, basically.
When you look at neuroscience, do you feel now that the field has reached a point where it is?
Field is superb, I think, with young people who are doing really good things and with good systems. Corey Goodman, for example, doing superb work on Drosophila, right. on pathfinding and trying to understand synaptogenesis and how neurons find the appropriate target cells to innervate. And there are many other people also who were doing, I think, extremely good work. These people didn't exist at the time I went into it.
Right.
So
let me
say a few things about Drosophila is a wonderful system for neurobiology, right. because it has almost a century of genetic exploration has been done using fruit flies as the model system. The life cycle from egg to adult is about 10 days, and so you can do genetic experiments. And even though there's an enormous amount that's not known about the development of the nervous system. We do know the basic strategy now of how parts of the central nervous system of Drosophila are formed. And it's really interesting. Roger Sperry's initial insight of having gradients at right angles to one another, of gradients of molecules, concentration gradients of molecules, it's absolutely true, because in the embryo, Drosophila embryo, in the anterior portion of the cell, there's a gradient of bicoid, homeobox protein, a gene regulator, nanos in the posterior, and these proteins diffuse from anterior to posterior or vice versa. And there's a concentration gradient in nuclei of dorsal, with the highest concentration in the ventral portion of the embryo and the lowest in towards the dorsal. And so each nucleus, actually the embryo is starts fertilized with a single cell, with a single nucleus. Nuclei keep dividing until you have a single cell with about 5,000 nuclei. Only then cell membranes form and compartmentalize the nuclei. Before the cell membranes formed, these concentration gradients of gene regulators in at right angles to one another determines the fate of nuclei depending upon the position of the nuclei in the embryo. So in effect, the embryo is divided up into a checkerboard of clusters of cells, and the initial developmental fate of the of each cluster of cell is dependent upon its position in the embryo. Then there's a selection that takes place to select neuroblasts from the neuroepithelium. Actually, one of the homeobox genes that we found, NK2, initiates neural development in the most medial portion of the embryo, next to the ventral midline. And we've been interested in how you form a pattern, a very intricate pattern of NK2 expressing neuroectodermal cells and neuroblasts. Only some of the cells become neuroblasts, and about 52 patches of NK2 expressing cells are formed. What we find is that that NK2 is turned on in the ventral half of the embryo, but it's repressed. It's repressed by different repressors in the mesodermal analoga, in the mesectodermal analog on the bottom, on the top, anterior portion, posterior portion, so that each cluster is formed by at least four or five different species of repressors. And so the position of each cluster of neuroectodermal cells is determined, the time of that these cells appear is determined, and the position is determined. And from each cluster, a neuroblast then will be selected that will then undergo division and give rise to a set of neurons.
Creates the hardware of the nervous system and builds the sort of basic wiring pattern as a consequence of these initial decisions.
That's right. So basically you have a Cartesian coordinates, anterior, posterior,
right,
ventral, dorsal coordinates that are formed. And I think that that each cell has two kinds of molecular addresses, at least two kinds of molecular addresses. An internal molecular address, which is the complement of gene regulators that it expresses that determines cell type. And an external address, it's the cell surface molecules that are recognized by other cells that determine the position of the, they recognize the position of the cell in order to form appropriate synapses later on in development. It's fantastic.
Do you see the development of the nervous system now as being reaching a stage where it's powerful enough to manipulate the system and give us a lot of insight, not only into the original signals that control how it's built, but also to the signals that are influencing that later stage that you were talking about, where information is processed through synapses? I mean, is that part of your imagination now?
Well, I would really like to know the synaptic circuits. I mean, in nematodes, we know the synaptic circuits and all cells in the nervous system. We also know the genome, the whole genome of the nematode now. But that information is not available in Drosophila. I think the major problems that has to be worked out is how cells find the right synaptic targets, how they make synapses and form appropriate synaptic circuits, and what the molecular basis of memory is.
Do you think there's going to be simple universal rules that are still to be discovered, rather like the genetic code, or do you think it's...
Oh, I think so.
Yes.
I think so, absolutely. I think from what we know now, molecules that are active as attractants or repellents for pathfinding, axon pathfinding in Drosophila, are also active in mammalian systems, in mammals. So insights from Drosophila, certainly I think many of them will be translated into mechanisms that are used in higher organisms.
Surely.
But I don't know, about a code. We still don't know how cells recognize one another to form appropriate synaptic partner cells. Interestingly, like muscle cells in Drosophila, when the axons crawl in, the muscle cell reaches out and palpates the incoming axons, and when the appropriate one is touched, pulls it in, and a synapse is formed. So it must be an adhesive interaction of some kind.
Yes, and when you sort of look in a fairly relaxed way out to the future, I mean, what do you see as the future of biology? I mean, do you see these?
Biology.
Yeah,
I think that you're working on part of the future of biology. Why don't you tell us something about stem cells?
Well, I could tie it in quite nicely with some of the things that you've been describing. I mean, when you talk about Sperry, I think Roger Sperry was a very, very influential figure, and more influential, it seems, almost as the years go by, and that his recognition that chemistry was going to be a crucial part of understanding the nervous system, I think, was not widely recognized. And when he won the Nobel Prize, he won it for work which was really, he was cited for work which was not the work really on neurochemistry, but was work on circuitry, where he did incredibly important work. And his work strongly influenced me. And I think one sees often in science, I mean, when you made a transition from molecular biology, bacterial genetics, and the fundamentals of molecular biology into neurobiology, so too did others. And like you, I was very influenced by Sperry and by a particular paper which was published in PNAS in the early 60s. And after a period being interested in the very general rules, chemical rules, the existence essentially of this chemistry that Sperry had predicted, I became very interested in the idea of stem cells. And that's an idea which just recently has become very popular, but in the initial part of working on them was very essentially unpopular, not really so much unpopular as not understood. And now as we move forward from this point, it's very clear that stem cells are real things, that cells have extraordinary properties, and that it relates a little bit to the work that you were describing in Drosophila, where cells become specified in different positions in the developing fly to occupy different fates. In the nervous system of mammals, and almost certainly in flies also, These cells in the early nervous system share properties. They share many properties. And in mammals, we know now how to get them out and grow them in the lab. And as we look at their properties in more detail, and we learn about them,
How did you isolate them?
Initially, it was very difficult to isolate them because initially we didn't know. The parallels with the story you told are interesting because we didn't know how to do it. So we had to have a very strong idea that we wanted to do it. And what we initially did was we generated a whole lot of antibodies which recognized the different cell types of the early nervous system and then showed by looking in the animal itself, as scientists say, in vivo, that one of these antibodies recognized a cell type that must be the precursor to neurons. And we did that really by a method which involved counting all the cells during development of the nervous system and proving mathematically that this cell population must give rise to neurons. And when we were confident of that, then we worked out how to grow that cell population in the lab and take it out of the animal, out of the in vivo situation, into an in vitro controlled experimental situation. It's rather parallel to your cell-free synthesis of proteins. And so one of the motivations that drives me forward is the idea that we can actually build brains in dishes. And while I think if you push that idea too far, it becomes ludicrous, as a motivating force to find the basic rules that construct the nervous system, it's a really good idea, it's a really good driving force to set up new experiments. And in fact, one of the experiments that we've recently completed is that we now know how to take these stem cells, which we can get to divide for long periods in culture, and then switch them into the young neuron and keep them healthy and happy all the way to the point where they form synapses. And that's a very interesting technology. It's mostly at the moment highly experimental, but we can see already how it will translate into clinical outcomes. But my own motivation for doing it is really intellectual. I think it's going to be very interesting to see now what the rules are that control these transitions and how you build groups of neurons with active synapses between them. Mm. And the thing that personally gets me most excited is the idea that, almost the abstract idea, that we'll be able to have and control whole dishes full of cells which are making different kinds of synapses and look at their information processing in almost an abstract way. Hmm. Of course, there is a sense in which that ambition is simply a personal one.
How many kinds of synapses can you form?
Well, we anticipate that we'll be able to form all the synapses that are found in the nervous system, but we know already that we can control the formation of the major excitatory and inhibitory synapses in these cells in ways which parallel the formation of synapses by normal neurons. So these stem cells look as if they make real neurons that have expected properties when one looks at their synapses. And so...
Are you collaborating with a electrophysiologist?
Yes, well, so I've been very fortunate in having interactions with Menachem Siegel, who's at the Weizmann Institute, and he spent some time here. And now we have in our own group colleagues who are electrophysiologists, and it's a very interesting multidisciplinary team. And it's exciting. I think that in terms of what you were describing, you talked about these two phases of the sort of the use of genes to form the basic structures. And I like to think of the stem cell really as the device that creates the Big Bang. It creates all the elements. But the universe it creates is kind of flat. It has interesting features, but it's slow. But when neurons are generated out of this early Big Bang, that's in a sense the parallel that I like to think of, is that it's like the origin of life. Now you have much more rapid information flux and more complex patterns. You ask about different kinds of synapses, and I think this is really a sort of romantic idea, but I think one of the important rules that I feel was true in the early days of molecular biology is that you have to have a kind of driving force which is essentially intellectual, and there is a sort of romantic component to it. And I think, for example, the group in Paris that understood the importance of being able to study the regulation of gene expression understood that as an intellectual or romantic idea.
Absolutely.
And that moved them forward. And they had the self-confidence to follow that idea, even when it wasn't clear experimentally how you would do it. Actually, one of the members of that group is a man called Leveauf, and he the person. He very famous scientist, and one of the things he said once was, when he was in his lab was the first lab to control how the transition from the activation of bacterial viruses, bacteriophage, which were latent. And he describes that moment in his lab as being the greatest molecular thrill of his life.
He was terrific. He told me one time that you have to, if you discover something, you have to name it. If it doesn't have a name, it doesn't exist.
Right.
So a very, very, a very interesting individual.
So my sort of romance at the moment, my intellectual drive is really to understand the relationship between these two important events, the Big Bang when the stem cell generates the components, and the first time when these components, if you like, become alive.
Do you think you can do replacement of neurons in damaged brains?
Yes, it's surprising. It looks very promising, that application of the technology, and in animal systems, we already have very convincing data that we can do that. And I think in the short term, there's going to be clinical trials which apply these new technologies to diseases of the nervous system. And my anticipation is that this is all going to happen very quickly. I think we're going to see a really dramatic switch in biology in the next few years. Comparable, I think, to the late 50s and 60s, when molecular biology just swept everything before it and suddenly became recognized as a major new force in biology. I think that's going to happen again now at the level of cells. I absolutely believe in the properties of these cells, and I do that actually based on, I think cells are really the unit of life, and that it's cells that are selected for, and that the properties of stem cells are really truly remarkable, and their plasticity is unexpectedly startling. So recent work suggests that within the nervous system, that cells can switch from to completely new fates if you put them in another part of the brain, and it looks as if that kind of flexibility in the differentiation of cells is going to apply throughout animals. So I think that in the next few years,
do you think that they'll form appropriate synapses?
Yes. Well, so
if you implant the progeny of stem cells or stem cells in the brain, let's say of Alzheimer's disease patients or Parkinsonian patients.
I think it's one of the challenges that we face, and I think that providing a detailed answer to that question, I think is going to be extraordinarily interesting. I think it's going to be answering that question that takes molecular biology into the realms of psychology and psychophysics in a very powerful way. I mean, consider what we're looking at here in this conversation. I mean, we're looking at a span of biology which takes us from a time when we didn't know the fundamental rules about how cells work and how information flows through cells, to a point where we're discussing the idea that there will be people who have Parkinson's disease who are grafted with highly defined populations of cells. And that one of the things that we will ask these people, I mean, we will actually ask them to tell us about their abilities and what they can do now and what they cannot do. And that when we ask them that question, we will essentially be answering the problem, which is how does it matter what these cells do? And I think that's extraordinary. You know, Jack Monod made this very famous statement in molecular biology that what is true for the elephant is true for E. coli. And for a long time, that drove molecular biology and the simplification of questions down to the level of phage and bacteria. But then Mono and others lifted their sights, you amongst them. And I think that now we're in a period where, in fact, it's Mono's famous aphorism's not true. It's not that it's not true, but in fact, if you want to know specific things about elephants, there are things that you cannot ask in E. coli. And I think that now we are getting to a point where we can ask, actually, people questions about the molecular biology of cells and synapse formation, which I think would make Mono extraordinarily interested. I mean, he was driven as an intellectual, I think, by many of this, by many of these questions. He was driven intellectually to answer the questions and simplified the problem because he felt these issues had to be resolved first. And now I anticipate this is all going to happen very fast, actually, that it won't take long to answer some of the questions. It'll take a long time to have a really detailed understanding, but to establish the paradigm of working in this way, I think, is going to happen very quickly.
You know, there have been some wonderful advances in neurobiology, that a lot of advances, but one of the most interesting is the work on the olfactory system, how we smell. And Richard Axel and his colleagues and others have discovered that in the mammalian genome, in the mouse genome, there are about 1,000 genes for olfactory receptors. And they're related. These genes encode related proteins. There's serpentine receptors that go in and out of the membrane seven times, and that perceive molecules. And this is that one can smell. That one can right. smell. The really remarkable thing about it is that these neurons are generated in the olfactory epithelium, and they seem to be genes are turned on randomly in a cell. One neuron expresses one olfactory receptor gene, and the rest of the genes, the other 999 genes, are turned off, and the other chromosome pair, that the gene is right. turned off as well. Allelic exclusion. So there has to be a mechanism
yes.
for it. When you turn on one of this right. set of genes, you turn off all the other genes.
Right.
And that mechanism is unknown right now. Then the neurons, all neurons that express receptor type A, synapse in the same place yes. in the olfactory bulb in the brain. And all neurons that express olfactory receptor B synapse in another separate place. So there are about 900 glomeruli in the brain that are formed. So there's a topographic map that's formed in the olfactory bulb. These neurons are distributed, olfactory neurons are distributed rather randomly in the olfactory epithelium, but they sort out and know where to synapse. And he and his colleagues have recently shown that the olfactory receptors have an instructive role. They're involved in part of the sensing the proper place to go. Nobody truly understands right now how the neurons can find their way to the right place to make this topographic
yes.
map. Of cells.
So there's going to be lots of sort of examples like that, don't you think, of really sort of remarkable phenomena.
Yes.
So in this case, a whole group of receptors which sense all of the chemical environment, the volatile chemical environment. And it seems you were talking about Drosophila earlier, and I meant to introduce his name at that point, but it seems to me that Seymour Benzer's lab, working on flies, has contributed yeah. repeatedly stunning observations using genetics.
He's one of the best scientists in the world. I mean, there's no question about that.
Right. I agree.
He's done superb work. He was, I think, one of the first people that I know, molecular biologists, to go into neurobiology.
Yes.
And he's done beautiful work in neurobiology.
There are a number of remarkable stories there, but one of them is the identification of genes that regulate an animal's sense of time. And
yes.
so there's a gene called PER for periodicity. It controls periodic behaviors. Singing, when flies sing to each other, it controls the frequency with which the flies sing. But it's a fundamental part of biology. obtained first, our insight into it obtained first from work in Drosophila using Drosophila genetics.
Yes.
I think it's going to be extraordinary this next period. I sometimes wonder whether, in fact, most of biology is now going to be done in the nervous system. That this sort of transition that
75% of all the genes that are expressed in the mammal are expressed in the nervous system.
Right. Allelic exclusion probably exists in other tissues.
Think so?
Well, isn't it the case in immunology, I think, that in...
Well, definitely, yes. Right. What do you think the mechanism of the allelic exclusion is in the olfactory receptor? It could be recombination.
It could simply be timing. It could just be frequency. If you have an event which is relatively infrequent, but in fact it happens rather rarely, so it could be a very simple device, or it could be very complex. At any rate, Marshall, this is very nice talking to you like this.
Well,
I've enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it too.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.